Years ago.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Tiger Woods says he's to start living a life of integrity. The world's number one golfer's apologised to everyone he's let down. He also dismissed reports his wife had ever attacked him, saying he was the one who had affairs and cheated and only the one to blame. Tiger admitted he needs help and is getting therapy.
I want to say to each of you, simply and directly, I am deeply sorry for my irresponsible and selfish behaviour I engaged in.
A 20-year-old man is being questioned by police in connection with the fatal stabbing of his 9-year-old brother. The young victim, named locally as Jack Taylor, was knifed at a house in Bradford last night. Jack's 18-year-old sister was also injured in the attack and is being treated in hospital. Thousands of steelworkers are to be balloted on industrial action in protest at Chorus mothballing one of its plants. 1,600 face losing their jobs on Teesside, but hundreds more will be hit locally. The GMB union says the decision is bad for Britain and the manufacturing industry. There is evidence children as young as 5 from around the country are being wrongly identified as overweight. A mum from Dorset's received a letter about her children's body mass, and she insists the system of measuring her daughter is flawed. Well, sport, and Great Britain could win its first individual Winter Olympics gold medal in 30 years tonight. Amy Williams is a leader at the halfway stage of the women's skeleton competition. She set a new track record and is now 2 runs away from the sport's biggest prize in Vancouver. The 27-year-old has described the thrill of riding a sled so fast and so close to the ground.
You've got like maybe up to 4 G-forces pushing down on your back. So your head can be on the ice scraping along. You've got the wind that you can hear sort of coming through your helmet. You know, you can be a bit shaky, a bit scared if you've taken a few bumps.
And the director and screenwriter of The Railway Children has died. Lionel Jeffries, also an actor mostly in the 50s and 60s, was 83. Among his most famous roles was as Caractacus Potts, father in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That's the latest. I'm Ursula Hansford.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice. Your choice. Digital TV switchover is coming to the West Region in March. Everybody in Bristol needs to be ready. Do you know someone who might need help in switching to digital TV? If they are 75 or over, registered blind or partially sighted, or eligible for disability benefits, the Switchover Help Scheme offers them practical help to convert one of their TV sets to digital. To get the help, they need to respond to the letter the Help Scheme has sent them. If you know someone who is eligible, give them a helping hand and remind them to apply for the help they are entitled to. You could even help them fill out their application form or ask them to call free on 0800 4087 656. The Switchover Help Scheme is run by the BBC under agreement with the government. For further information, visit the website helpscheme.co.uk. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
You're listening to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. The new SAP IT system at Avon and Somerset Police has been roundly called a disaster. This programme is revealing that Somerset County Council will announce next week a full review of multi-million pound IBM and Southwest One privatisation deal, which was signed 2 years ago with Avon and Somerset Police, Somerset County Council and Taunton Deane Borough Council. We also have an exclusive interview with the legal advisor to the family of a rape gang in Aberdeen. This harrowing interview will be playing later on. He was arrested last week by the same police force who were accused of a cover-up. Before that, we've got some music.
I have money excuses. Everybody is the same.
Natalie Merchant, 10,000 Maniacs, from the MTV Unplugged album, and that's What's the Matter Here. Now, I'm joined by Marina Morris. This week, she's been looking at how children can inherit behaviour from their parents. Marina, what have you been finding out?
Hello, Tony. The latest findings from the Fuel on Tom studies on childhood obesity in Britain show that daughters of overweight mothers are 10 times more likely to be obese by the time they reach age of 8 than a daughter born to a slim mother. Sons of obese fathers are 6 times more likely to be overweight, according to the research from scientists working on the Early Birds Diabetic Project at the medical school in Plymouth. Children of fat parents inheriting parental behavioral patterns resulted in them being overfed and under-exercised. Tony, I would like to change our rules. Can I ask you one question?
Yes, you certainly can. Yeah, go on.
Okay. One in six people of the UK's 60 million population suffer from depression or chronic anxiety and feels unhappy. Following this logic, the latest government polls found that children in England are unhappier than they were a year ago. Do you think what percentage of English children are happy with their life? A. 52%, B. 67%, or C. 76%.
Well, this is a multiple choice, isn't it? How many children are happy generally with their life? I'm going to guess and say 67%.
Okay, we will see if you are right at the end of our conversation. And again, latest information. Last year, a European league table of young people's well-being placed the UK 24th out of 29 countries. Europe's happiest children, according to the research by a York University team, are in the Netherlands and Scandinavia. Only Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania and Malta scored worse than the UK, according to the research which was based on data from 2006. How can this be in the one of the wealthiest European country? The UK has one of the highest level of average per capita income, according to the statistic from the World Bank, higher than Belgium, France, Germany or Italy. What's wrong? Labour said the children's plan was intended to make Britain the best place in the world for young people to grow up and promised sweeping reform affecting health, education, child safety and recreation. A recent report advised that Britain's children are afraid of bullying, stressed by schoolwork, beset by concern over relationship, worried about family and abuse. Last year, Childline received calls from 195,000 and 485 children desperate for help. There is the root of this unhappiness of children in the home, in the school, the family, the country, or the attitude of society. And again, why in the wealthier country in the world one in six people have depression? It is a root of the same problem. We have only one way to decide this issue: to return back to our nature. How does nature make us? What crucial things do we ignore and doesn't understand? Childhood should be an idyllic time, the best day of their life. Parents love children and do their best for them. But how can unhappy parents make children's lives happier when they don't know how to be happy themselves? Children echo their parents, become parents themselves, and the issue replicates through generation. There are two important big mistakes which steal and crush future happiness from children and parents. The first, a very rational attitude towards life. Do parents know and explore the personal unique talents and abilities of their children? It's future happiness. Do parents try to help them find a special path in their life, leading to their happiness? The latest survey indicates that 70% people don't like their job. Job satisfaction in the UK is decreasing in the recession. And secondly, we don't use our natural potential to develop and grow skills and talents. Every child is unique and extraordinary and has the potential to achieve their highest goals, top levels. Like a great caterpillar, they can transform into a beautiful butterfly. The parents' duty is to inspire children for future success and achieve to their potential. Don't make mental boundaries for children. The simple phrases like "you're not good enough" or "you can't do that" is digging a grave for children's potential success, happiness and future. Parents have to reprogram in mind and remove the "would can't" from their vocabulary. In the word of the queen, every princess can do. It's crucial. This new time needs a new vision and new attitude. Global think. Think big. And finally, about answer to the question about what percentage of the UK's children are happy. Yes, Tony, congratulations. You are exactly right. 67% of our children feel happy. Years ago, it was 69. Every one in three is unhappy, and this is based on the survey of 2054 hungry school children aged from 10, 12 and 15.
But Marina, I've got a question for you here, because how did you know I was going to get the question right?
I don't know.
you just guessed.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that. Now, we've got the report coming up in a minute about this bit of an exclusive, really, we've got, because it's going to be in the news next week that Somerset County Council will be reviewing this privatisation contract between South West One, IBM and Avon and Somerset Police, Civilian Support Services, plus also the Somerset County Council and Taunton Deane Borough Council. But before that, let's have a bit of Stevie Wonder.
You can feel was Sir Duke by Stevie Wonder, a tribute to Duke Ellington. And what's going to happen now then, Tony?
Well, I think, why don't we have a discuss one of the news stories we didn't have time for when Gary was here, which is about Twitter. The head of the Royal Air Force said last week on Tuesday, I think it was in the Independent, or either the Independent or Telegraph, I can't remember, I'm sorry, but he said that the armed forces must embrace internet technology. It sounds to me like cyber warfare, but anyway, Britain needs to learn, apparently, from the actions of the Israeli military in the Gaza conflict, in using YouTube and tweets to engage in 21st century cyber warfare. The head of the Royal Air Force has said in his Air Chief Marshal Sir Stephen Dalton, accurate and timely information, he says, has always been critical to the military, but its importance is increasing as societies become more networked, he stated. This is ultimately linked to developments in space and cyber warfare, as we saw in the conflict in Gaza in early 2009. I mean, I suppose, Martin, these two areas of space warfare and spying from space and cyber warfare are a bit like, and I'm not surprised it's the RAF that's talking about this, because over the years, of course, we started off with land armies, then we started having land armies and sea armies and the Navy, and the Air Force is the most recent addition to the armed forces, and now it looks like we've got sort of satellite space armies with the spy satellites and things like that, and now cyber warfare too, so we've got kind of internet forces. So what's the significance of the RAF actually coming out and saying this?
Well, I think we shouldn't confuse what you might call conventional cyber warfare, you know, satellites taking photographs of bomb damage and so on, with what's being suggested here.
Well, we're talking about, yeah, satellites being used to target people.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, but what I find most significant about this and rather worrying is that we've got the head of the RAF talking about what we can learn from the Israeli assault on Gaza last year. What does that suggest about whose side we're on to poor Muslim boys in shanty towns up and down the all over the world?
Well, surely it shouldn't matter which side we're on if one side has been using this to their advantage.
But what he means by this is actually what the Israelis do is they get onto the virtual reality net and they basically spread disinformation about what they're doing and what's going on, and also pretending to be other people than they are. So pretending to be Palestinians, making extreme remarks, etc., etc. Now, this doesn't surprise me. We know that this goes on, this kind of psychological warfare, the attempt to blacken your enemies by pretending to be them and saying stupid things,
this is
by hacking into their communication.
This is what's commonly known as black propaganda. Isn't it?
Yeah. And I find it extremely worrying that the head of the Royal Air Force thinks that it is in some way the Israeli assault on Gaza and the cyber assault on those who were criticising what was going on in Gaza is some kind of model to follow. I mean, we know that this is what goes on, but I'm astonished that he's come out and said it. And frankly, if you are going to engage in that kind of skullduggery, it's not very wise to broadcast it to everybody, is it?
He goes on to say, but we must not get fixed. In the future, our adversaries may use cyber attacks against our network systems. Indeed, our national computer systems are under constant and intensifying attacks today. Martin, do you think some of our defence computers could possibly be vulnerable to cyber attacks?
Well, of course they are. I mean, cyber warfare is a major facet of what goes on. I mean, during the NATO air assault on Serbia a few years ago, it was quite possible for NATO to have taken down the Serbian air defence using electronic means. The reason they didn't do it, I understand, is because then everybody would have understood how to do it. And then, of course, your air defence could be taken down by electronic means. This kind of electronic warfare is, in a sense, only to be expected if we're going to have wars. That's what it's going to be about. But what worries me is this whole idea of psychological warfare, using the net to spread disinformation and lies. As the old adage says, the first casualty in any war is truth. You're a journalist. It's not war. It's about truth. We've got to have the truth if we're going to understand what war's about. And if the government is using our money to spread lies and disinformation, especially to confuse us, not to confuse the enemy, then that's illegitimate in my view.
I suppose another thing is actually getting journalists who are sympathetic to the enemy embedded in the enemy country. I mean, is that feasible?
Well, there's all sorts of things you can do. But I think that at the same time, if you're a democratic... if you're serving a democratic regime, you shouldn't be using your resources to bamboozle your own population about what's going on. We all know it goes on. Propaganda is everywhere. But I personally resent my taxes being used to tell me lies.
another story, which is all sort of balances this one out a bit, because that one was rather depressing. I feel a little bit, you know, rather depressed now to think that this is the sort of thing the military are going to try and do in the future, potentially.
They're already doing it. Let's not kid ourselves.
It is a story which you pointed out to me. Iceland is aiming to become an offshore haven for journalists and leakers. On Tuesday, the Icelandic Parliament introduced, or is expected anyway, to introduce a measure that was earlier this week, aimed at making the country an international centre for investigative journalism publishing by passing the strongest combination of source protection, freedom of speech and libel tourism prevention laws in the world. Supporters of the proposal say the move would make Iceland an offshore publishing centre for free speech, analogous to the offshore financial havens that allow corporations to hide their capital from authorities. Now, as you know, many websites do get legal threats and legal attacks and are forced to be closed down. In fact, I've had a couple from websites of mine. Basically, what you do is you go to a big lawyer in London, like Shillings, and you pay them a vast amount of money, and they send loads of letters. It doesn't almost matter what the facts are of whether you've actually published the truth or not. If a internet service provider is getting letters from maybe even four or five different countries in different languages, all saying, take this down or you'll be sued, it's basically just a legal threatening letter. That usually the ISPs cave in, and they have to be a very, very strong internet service provider not to do that. What they're essentially saying here is for websites like WikiLeaks, which is one of the places that I would go to, for example, if I had information which someone was trying to stop me putting out, I would send there. It sounds to me like this is absolutely married with the idea of using the internet to publish information that some rich and powerful people want to shut down.
Yes, and WikiLeaks have helped to draw up this legislation in Iceland. At one stage, WikiLeaks themselves were under an injunction. The Icelandic government wanted, people in the parliament, I believe, wanted to expose aspects of the financial crisis, and the Icelandic banks were trying to use libel law and so on to prevent this from coming out. So what the news programmes in Iceland did is they said, we can't tell you about this, but just check this website, WikiLeaks, and you'll see what's going on. So they got round the law, the existing law, by just pointing people in the direction of the internet. And of course, this has then led to this head of steam in Iceland to set up this offshore haven for journalists and hackers. And I say good luck to them. I mean, we need more information, real information, not disinformation. Coming back to what we were talking about previously, cyber warfare, telling lies in cyberspace. Well, there's only one answer to people who tell lies, is make sure that the truth is out there.
Well, it's worth mentioning that one of the people that's been on the radio the last few days talking about this Mossad operation and the sorts of things that the Israeli secret services get up to, and I'm not entirely sure whether these Israeli secret service is any better or worse than anywhere else. What do you think?
They punch way above their weight, but of course they don't do anything that the US and Britain engage in selective assassination in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mark Urban's just written a book, Guardian journalist, suggesting that the SAS have killed over 450 targets inside Iraq. So we're not really in a position to point our finger at anybody.
Anyway, the book is called Gideon's Spies. The chap that's been doing the rounds is Gordon Thomas. Unfortunately, not on our programme this evening, but Gideon's Spies is the book, The Secret History of the Mossad. Because there, of course, are lots of books on the Mossad. Some are better than others. I don't know if you know anything about this particular author, Martin.
It's quite a good, comprehensive book. I haven't read it, but I have flicked through it. Viktor Ostrovsky, who used to work for Mossad, his book is very good. Ostrovsky. He used to work for Mossad in the 70s and the 80s, and he talks about some of the things that they get up to. Not that the Israelis are the only people who get up to nonsense. We know they all get up to nonsense.
Okay. The new SAP, or SAP IT systems, at Avon and Somerset Police have been roundly called a disaster. This programme reveals that Somerset County Council will announce next week a full review of the multi-million pound IBM and Southwest One privatisation deal, which was signed 2 years ago. Taunton Deane Borough Council and Avon and Somerset Police were also part of this privatisation, which, amid allegations of corruption in the House of Commons by Ian Liddell Granger, Bridgewater MP, was project managed by Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police, Colin Port's wife, Sue Barnes. She was paid about £200,000 for her work. Somerset County councillors have complained that under the new regime, the chief executive and press officers particularly have been acting like a law unto themselves, At one meeting where the chief executive failed to turn up, one elected member asked Somerset press officer Mr. Clifford, who had advised him not to come, and received a short reply. Asked Mr. Clifford who had advised him not to come. And he received a short reply, "What the hell's it got to do with you?" But unbeknown to the press officer, it was all caught on video.
He's been told not to.
Told
not to by who?
Be given advice.
By who?
What the hell's it got to do with you?
Excuse me, I'm an elected member of Somerset County Council. I don't like your attitude. You're a press officer of the County Council, is that correct? It has an awful lot to do with me. I've asked you a civil question. You're an officer of the county. I expect a civil response, sir. Simply unacceptable behaviour, sir. Perhaps you can understand what I've been going through for the last 2 years in some small degree now. The sort of power that Jones has over his staff and the sort of instruction that he gives and the behaviour that I have been subject to from County Council staff for the last 2 years. Once again, you're turning your back on me and walking away. This is no way to face senior politicians, Mr. Clifford.
The big player in this privatisation deal has been IBM, International Business Machines, a company that one Jewish writer in the United States, Edwin Black, has been looking into very closely. He published his research in a book called IBM and the Holocaust.
I'm here to demonstrate to you why IBM is guilty of genocide and consciously helping to co-plan and co-organize the destruction and murder of millions of people consciously for money. And I brought the documents with me, some of them. And this book, IBM and the Holocaust, and there's a website for it, IBMandTheHolocaust.com, and my own website, EdwinBlack.com, came out 10 years ago, and IBM can't deny it. And the reason I can't deny it is because they know that they consciously engaged in genocide, micromanaged by Thomas J. Watson personally. And so, tomorrow morning, the management of the Endicott Visitor Center will not get a letter of complaint from the IBM legal team. They will get silence. But you will have the benefit of seeing the actual documents, and you'll be able to ask me any questions. So I'm going to explain to you exactly how it happened. When Hitler came to power in January of 1933, January 30th of 1933, his goal was to destroy all the Jews, not only in Germany, but throughout Europe. And this required the resources of a computer. But in 1933, there was no such thing as a computer as we know it today. There was instead the Hollerith punch card system, which stored information on any person, any action, any quantity, any process in the holes that were punched into rows and columns. Those were then subjected to a magnetic reader, and the information could be not counted, but cross-tabulated. IBM owned information technology. They had a monopoly on it. Even the 10% of American information technology that was given to Remington Rand was an expensive license to pretend that they did not have 100% of the market. So when Hitler came to power, he wanted to destroy the Jews. He wanted to murder them. He wanted to evict them, pauperize them. The only company on earth that could have orchestrated that, organized it, planned it, IBM, under the personal supervision of Thomas J. Watson, did so. They organized custom-made programs to automate all six phases of the Holocaust. The identification of the Jews, their expulsion from society, the confiscation of their assets, the ghettoization, the deportation, even the extermination of the Jews.
That was, I can't remember the name of the chap.
Edwin Black speaking. Edwin. Actually, he was, just to let you know, he was speaking in the United States in September 2009, actually at a place called Endicott, New York, which was the birthplace and longtime headquarters of IBM. Yes, Edwin Black's his name in his book, IBM and the Holocaust.
Yeah, and it wasn't just IBM that were implicated in the cooperating with the Nazi regime. Many senior corporations and senior business people were cooperating with the Nazi regime both before and during World War II. Probably the most prominent one that would be known to people listening to this programme would be Prescott Bush, who was the grandfather of George W. Bush. He was Hitler's main financial backer on Wall Street. You don't hear that on mainstream radio, do you, Tony?
No, you do hear, though. Anyway, how exactly did IBM make it possible for the Nazis to virtually wipe out the Jews and other minority groups? This, again, is another extract from this talk done by Edwin Black in Endicott, New York, the birthplace and headquarters for a long time of IBM, back in September last year.
How'd they do it? Well, first Hitler said, we want to know where the Jews are. Some of the Jews were in synagogues. Some of them did not even know they were Jewish because their grandparents had converted to Christianity. They were actually worshiping in churches, in Catholic cathedrals. Some of them were recognizable because they wore traditional religious headgear. Others looked like ordinary businessmen. How do we find out where the Jews are? IBM, the solutions company, said, we have the solution. And indeed, there was no solution that IBM was not willing to give to the Nazis. IBM invented the racial census for the Nazis. Here we need to understand that the information age that you all are aware of, did not begin in Silicon Valley. It began in Berlin in 1933. And when I say the information age, I specifically mean the individualization of statistics. That is the information age. So IBM devised a racial census where they would punch in one column the religion, in a second column, the mother tongue, in the third column, the nationality, in the fourth column, the profession, and the fifth column, the residence. Then at the rate of 24,000 cards per hour, like that, the Nazis know all the Jews of Polish extraction in Berlin engaged in the fur trade. Once Hitler said, we don't have the resources to undertake such a census, IBM said, and Watson specifically directed them to say, we will do it for you. We'll hire the people, we'll do the tabulation, we'll rent the facilities. Once the names were known, they were cross-tabulated against lists. The professors, the directory of professors, the directory of judges, the directory of doctors, the motor club, the gardening club, the phone book. And they could find out who were the Jewish judges, who were the Jewish doctors, who were the Jewish bankers, expel them. And then came the third phase, confiscation, get their assets. All the banks and financial institutions in Nazi Germany ran on Hollerith punch cards. Now we know their name. We've thrown them out of their job. We've made it impossible for them to work. And now we're going to seize their bank accounts. We're going to seize their insurance. We're going to seize their property. We're going to organize their assets. The fourth phase was ghettoization. IBM and its Hollerith punch card system was a master at moving people, tracking people, quantifying people. One day, everybody gets up, thrown out of their house, they know exactly where to go, they're sent over into ghettos, 5, 6, 7, 8 families into one cramped apartment, like that. Efficient. Not only in one city, but in many cities, not only in one country, but in several countries around Europe. Deportation. The Jews sent on trains, like my mom was sent on a train. All the trains in Europe ran on IBM punch cards. I personally interviewed the Polish man who worked for the IBM process at 22 Pawierstrasse in Krakow, organizing the trains. They went to Auschwitz full, they came back empty. They went to Auschwitz full, they came back empty. They even organized the extermination of the Jews by creating and masterminding the extermination by labor campaign, where they would catalog all your skills. Are you a doctor? Are you a bricklayer? Are you a metal worker? Once they had your skills, they would cross-tabulate that against where they needed slave labor. They would move people across the country on special trucks and trains, on Hollerith lists. They would work them to death. And after they were worked to death, they would then have them gassed. And IBM had a code for that, too. In fact, the Auschwitz tattoo began as an IBM number.
That was Edwin Black there, author of IBM and the Holocaust, talking about the murky past of International Business Machines Company, where the review will be being announced next week into the modern-day version of IBM's privatisation of the police civilian support services, Avon and Somerset Police, and also at Taunton Deane Borough Council and Somerset County Council. Now, let's have a little bit of music from Madonna.
I don't wanna hear it. I don't wanna hear it.
with me.
That's the sound of Madonna with Sorry. Now, is Britain's criminal justice system robust enough to deal with the sexual abuse of vulnerable children when paedophile rape gangs may be blackmailing public officials? Some of the abusers themselves, could they even hold key posts in the criminal justice system? Well, that's the contention of a legal advisor to the family of one in particular of these abuse cases in Aberdeen, that of Holly Grieg. It just so happens that I interviewed Robert Green, this is the legal advisor, when he was down in Bristol last November, and I was shocked to hear last weekend that Robert had been arrested by the same force, Grampian Police, which the family he's representing is accusing of one of their officers, who's now dead, of abusing Holly over a number of years. I'll warn you now that this is a harrowing account. I have had to bleep out the name for legal reasons of a serving judge who's accused by the family of being part of this paedophile rape gang.
My name is Robert Green. I'm representing Holly Gregg and her mother, Anne Gregg, regarding the terrible issue of the paedophile rape gang operating in Aberdeen. It's a rather long story, but it was discovered in 2000 by Anne's mother that Holly had been systematically raped, initially from the age of six by her father, an elder brother, and then a little later being shared with a gang in Aberdeen that included two nurses, two people from social services, a police officer called Terry Major from Grampian Police, and a judge, or as they're known in Scotland, a sheriff. And this was called Sheriff Graham. Most of the rapes took place at the home of the sheriff's sister Evelyn, which was used as a centre for the ring. All the matter was brought before the police. Holly gave all the evidence. There was medical evidence. There was expert witness evidence from psychiatrists to say that Holly was a credible and truthful witness, and all this was accepted. One would have thought, with that very clear evidence, not only about the perpetrators, but also the other known victims, and there were plenty of them, that action would have been taken in 2000. But no, it wasn't. It was prevented by the Procurator Fiscal of Aberdeen at the time, who, as the fans say on these matters, stopped the investigation. It transpired that the Procurator Fiscal, whose name is Elish Angelini, who has subsequently been promoted to the highest legal office in Scotland, that of Lord Advocate, was a personal contact, a personal associate of Sheriff Graham. And on that grounds, I would imagine that's the only possible reason why this gang was not brought to justice. It also confirms why things have not moved more smoothly in 2009, despite Holly giving the evidence all over again and other information coming forward, including Holly's medical notes that show that she'd been abused at the special school that she had from 1990. So all this was covered up. Anne Gregg, the mother, was never told, and Holly has suffered years and years of misery as a result of the people in the public services squashing this terrible, terrible situation.
That was Robert Green there, who I spoke to back in November last year, 2009, who was arrested the end of last week by the same police force who the family he represents are accusing of being involved in this child sexual abuse. So, why does Robert Green believe the criminal justice system has failed Holly?
I believe that the reason that the judicial process has not been resolved in the way that it should have been could be attributed to just one word. That one word is blackmail. Members of the within the authority in Aberdeen have in their own situation where they can literally blackmail each other. And we already know of medical officers, teachers, and a wide range of people being involved in paedophilia there, in addition to the people who are involved in Holly's case. This goes right to the top. We've talked about Sheriff. We talked about the former Procurator Fiscal, who was the highest authority in the area at the time. And, of course, it's now supported by, effectively supported by, the Scottish Government themselves. The First Minister, Alex Salmond, was first told about this case about 4 months ago, in which he has done very little apart from appoint certain people from the Crown Office to deal with it, but they have not been at all effective at the present time. I think it is important to realise that we'd already established with Alex Salmond that Elise Angelini and her current role as Lord Advocate this year, under pressure about the Holly story, even sought to lie to the officer put in charge of the case, Mr. Andrew McIntyre, Head of Victims and Diversity. Had a number of exchanges with Mr. McIntyre, and in one conversation later on in the summer, Mr. McIntyre said that all these complaints that we've been receiving from you about the Lord Advocate's role in the Holly Gregg case can't be true because she wasn't in situ as Procurator Fiscal in Aberdeen at the time and knows nothing about the situation. Well, I said, well, when did she become Procurator Fiscal, Mr. McIntyre? And he said, 21st of July 2000. And I said, well, I can tell you for sure that the names of all the main perpetrators, including Sheriff Graham and all the other members other than the father and brother, were named at Buckburn Police Station in Aberdeen on the 25th of August 2000. Mr. McIntyre then went on to say that he perhaps thought that members of the Procurator Fiscal's office had been dealing with it themselves without telling the Procurator Fiscal, which I thought was extremely odd concerning the hideousness of the crime and scale of the crime, and also that one of the main people involved with it was a personal friend of the Procurator Fiscal, Sheriff Graham. Mr. McIntyre was still a little stumped about this, but he still insisted that the Lord Advocate did not know anything about the case. I then was able to produce to Mr. McIntyre a letter from Holly's own MSP, Mr. Brian Adam, dated the 27th of October 2000, 4 months after Mrs. Angelini came into office as Procurator Fiscal. The letter is, we have copies of the letter. It was written directly to Mrs. Angelini, asking her precisely what progress she had been making in this terrible case. Mrs. Angelini, of course, has continued to claim that she knows nothing about the case. She has lied to a member of her own staff on this, on a matter of absolutely crucial importance. Therefore, Mr. Salmond, I think, is remiss in not actually making sure that Mrs. Angelini no longer remains as Lord Advocate of Scotland. I believe he is complicit in letting down the people of Scotland by allowing someone who has knowingly lied even to her own staff.
Well, I think many of us will be very, very surprised to hear these allegations that this kind of child sexual abuse could go right to the top. What does Robert Green have to say about that?
One of the difficulties we have is if you're an ordinary member of the public and you never fortunate enough to go through life never falling foul of anyone in a high-level official capacity, it is quite possible that you might think you're still living in a civilised, decent country where things looked after properly. It is only when you come to find out about these things, either personally or perhaps through friends or relatives, that you realise that the situation is nothing like as rosy as you would wish it to be. And I think the main problem is that we really need more people to be made aware of this. However, because the press are being so suppressed on this one, the chances of people being aware of all the problems that exist in society at this level are slim at the moment. These scandals only seem to come out very occasionally, and I think the public may well be led to believe that these are something very unusual. It's terrible, it's disgusting, but it happens once in every 10 years. It doesn't. It's happening all over the country. It's happening all over Scotland for sure, which I think is probably the worst area of the United Kingdom, but I have no reason to suspect that it's not happening in England, Wales and Northern Ireland as well, judging by the calls that I get. It's obviously terribly difficult to get within the minds of the people who perpetrate these terrible things. I think most of us would feel sick thinking about not only the things that people might do, but the sheer horror that they have this power, or feel this power, this extreme cruelty over abusing people in that way, people who they know will probably never be able to testify against them. It is absolutely barbaric, and I think it's sometimes difficult for people in society to think we have people living like this amongst us. I think a very popular misconception is that people still think of the pervert as the dirty old man in a raincoat standing outside the school offering bags of sweet to children. Well, I've no doubt that that particular type of person still exists, but what people overlook is that a lot of these perverts look like you and me and everyone else. They're quite often people from the professional classes, they're quite often respectable looking people with decent jobs, they look very much like anyone else, and that is the most frightening thing of all. It is some sort of perverted lust and power more than anything else. One of the things that does come up quite a lot is this tends to run in families. Even with Holly's group, the children were being abused, were the members of each other's families, and they were sharing them out with other parents in the group. And I understand that this is something that's been going back in time for many, many years in many of these families, and obviously how it can be brought to an end, I don't know, but the children are brought up with this rather unhappy and twisted perspective, which they carry on, perhaps doing what their mothers and fathers particularly have done to them before, without really having real morality about it.
Well, I mean, that's a very... very sad and disturbing story, Tony. The only comment I would like to make on that is that if your listeners were to do a search on their computers on the King Korra Boys Home scandal in Northern Ireland,
because it's a
King
bit of
Korra is
word.
K-I-N-C-O-R-A, King Korra. That was a boys home in Northern Ireland, and it was used by the intelligence services to entrap loyalist paramilitaries who came to the home to have sex with boys, but they were in fact being photographed and bugged while they were doing that, and then they were blackmailed by the British intelligence services. In fact, Ken Livingstone's first question as an MP was related to the King Korra Boys Home scandal.
Well, as Robert Green said there, that actually blackmail runs right throughout this particular case. Anyway, yeah. Our final clip is about the credibility of this, because as Robert will explain, the BBC have actually done a documentary into the abuse cases in Scotland, at several of them, which has been pulled.
Around the end of April, we were approached by a team from BBC Scotland, led by Mark Daly from BBC Television Scotland, supported by Cathy Long from BBC Radio Scotland, and later Liam McDougall from Panorama. Mark Daly, in writing, confirmed that two programmes had been commissioned. We worked very closely with them, providing all sorts of written documentation that we had, and we had a lot of it. The team came down to Shropshire to visit Anne and Holly on the 4th of June. Everything was going well. They were very happy that everything stood up, and they were determined to expose these people. Not only the Holly and Holly's case, but they had also told us that they'd discovered other instances of paedophilia in Scotland, which they were investigating. On the 10th of June, both Anne and I received a call from Mark Daly, in some distress, telling us that he had bad news for us. He had been blocked from doing not only Holly's story, but any story about paedophilia. He insisted that he had stood his ground in trying to say that he really felt this should be done, but was told finally that if he continued, he and the team continued in investigating any stories into paedophilia in Scotland, they would be dismissed. I said to Mark, I said, who told you this? Give me a name. Who's blocked you? Who stopped you? This is too big for names and everything like that. He refused to do so, and obviously subsequently has not contacted me again, despite the fact I've left the door open for him, as is the case with Cathy Long. In that time, I've been actually trying to find out what happened about this, because I've stressed what kind of person would actually want to prevent investigation in such horrific stories as Holly's. I couldn't understand the mentality of the person who would want to stop a story like that coming through. I've written several times to the Director General, Mark Thompson, And I've also, in failure to get a reply from him, I wrote to the head of the BBC Drustson, Michael Lyons.
Well, unfortunately, Robert hasn't received a reply, apparently, from either of those. And if you're wondering what this is about, it's accusations of child sexual abuse in Aberdeen. And that was Robert Green, who's a legal advisor to one of the families who was arrested last weekend. Anyway, that's nearly it for today's programme, but I will give you just two websites to do with that last story. One is sacl.info, that's www.sacl.info, which stands for Scotland Against Crooked Lawyers.info. And there's also another one, stolenkids-holly, that's stolenkids-holly.blogspot.com. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Bristol City Council Audit Committee Chair Jeff Gollop will be here on the Council's annual Budget Week with me to review the news. Thanks to Martin Summers and Marina Morris. See you next week.